Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Ladies and gentlemen, today is Election Day. It is your sacred privilege and duty to go out and vote. To talk about today's election, I would like to welcome today's guest, Jim Harrington. He is chair of the City of Santa Fe Charter Review Commission. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First of all, what is the city charter?
The city charter is comparable to a constitution for the city, as the constitution is for the country. It's the basic principles of the guide that form and guide the city government, and all the laws passed by the council have to conform to the charter. And it can only be amended by the voters.
And the charter is reviewed on a regular basis?
Yes. The charter itself provides that every 10 years the council and mayor have to appoint a charter review commission of citizens to review the charter and recommend any changes. And that's what was done here.
And that was done here. And so a number of the recommendations of the Charter Review Commission, which you chaired, are now on today's ballot, and I think some people don't necessarily know that much about them.
That's right. The council approved all of them with two small changes to two of them and put them on the ballot.
So the city council approved the charter review recommendations.
That's right. Yeah, the commission itself has no power to put things on the ballot. The council has to approve it, but both last time and this time they approved essentially everything that the commission recommended. We spent a year carefully deliberating and had numerous meetings. We're rather conservative in our recommendations. We rejected a lot of proposals that were brought to us.
Now, let's talk about some of the specific ones, and what we're going to do on today's show is I will actually read them, and then we will discuss what they mean and what's actually involved. And some of them, I mean, I just happen to be reading the ballot because I had the city council candidates on last week, and I came across public financing of campaigns. So they're proposing to amend the Santa Fe Municipal Charter to adopt an ordinance within 2 years after the effective date of this amendment, which would provide meaningful public financing of election campaigns for all municipal elected officials with an effective date of May 5th, 2008. Now, public financing of campaigns is something we've been talking about on a national level. What does it mean on a local level?
It would the amendment to the charter would leave it up to the city exactly what kind of system to adopt, and that was necessary because these ordinances tend to be somewhat complex public financing systems, and since the charter can only be amended by an election, you don't want to put something in the charter that might need tinkering in the light of experience and amendment. So the amendment would merely require that the city council adopt some form of meaningful public financing of campaigns within 2 years of the date of the charter amendment takes effect.
What is the impetus behind having public financing? I think it's just getting the money out of elections, the influence of money out of elections.
That's the principal one, is to get the influence of private money out of elections. As everyone knows from reading the paper nationally, locally, and everywhere else, the increasing expense of campaigns is a serious problem because it requires the candidates to go to people for large donations, and the people most willing to give large donations are those that have some financial interest in the official's action once he's elected. And that's not, there's never a quid pro quo, but those folks are doing that for a reason. They're profit-making entities. They expect to get something out of it, and in some way we think maybe they do. So to get that out of there is the main reason. The other two reasons are just to free public officials' time from the necessity to raise money. It's not as bad at the local level, but members of Congress, for example, spend their entire 2 years of their term essentially raising money to run again, and it would allow them to devote more time to thinking about questions of policy.
That's right. I mean, one hears stories about senators know so much more about fundraising for their own campaigns than they do about some of the issues that are brought to them by their constituents.
Exactly, exactly. For a congressman, it's his main job there.
Yeah.
The third reason is that it's the only constitutional way in which to limit the cost of campaigns. the courts have held that governments cannot directly pass laws restricting your right to spend money and to advance your own candidacy. Candidates can spend as much as they want. You can limit contributions, but not spending. But in public financing, the government offers a certain amount of money to finance the candidate's campaign, and in accepting it, they must agree to accept a spending limit and to take no private money.
So when, if this passes, and this is Charter Amendment Number 4 on today's ballot, then the City Council has to adopt an ordinance. Now, there are a number of choices that the City Council will actually have if and when they do adopt an ordinance, and that is full or partial public campaign financing.
Right, right. In fact, I have to modify something I just said. There is a type of public financing known as partial public financing, where the candidates would continue to raise private money, but the city would match it in some ratio, often one-to-one, such as in Tucson. So for every dollar they raise from private sources, the city will add a dollar, and in return for that, they agree to spending limits. That's generally a less costly system, of course, because you only have to pay a fraction for the same spending limit, but it doesn't accomplish the goal of getting private money out of campaigns. In fact, in some ways, it aggravates the problem by giving the candidates an additional incentive to raise money, because whatever they raise gets doubled or tripled, or depending on the ratio. The other system is full public financing. The candidates have to raise a large number, typically in a full public financing system, a large number of very small contributions, usually $5, and then they that's to qualify, to show that they have significant support. Then they turn that money over to the city, and the city pays the entire cost of their campaigns up to the limit established by the law.
And so those are basically the two choices, partial,
right,
which is about matching funds, and then full, which is
right,
about the city paying for it. Let's say you have an election for mayor, and as we often have in Santa Fe, many people decide that they want to run for mayor. They have to come up with a nominal amount of money. Does that put a huge burden on the city of Santa Fe?
Well, this is the big unknown. I mentioned that the ordinance might require tinkering, and if in the hopefully the council would set it up so that the first election to be, well, number one, they would establish a means of financing it and build up a fund with ample money in it before the first election were held. And then the first election, hopefully, would be the type of election we're having this year, a judge-council type of thing, instead of the mayor election, which tends to be more expensive. And then you see how many qualify, and the council, if too many people qualified and it was too expensive, the council could raise the bar, require more $5 contributions to qualify, try to narrow the field a little bit.
And so the $5 contribution is so that if somebody is, you know, the candidate of the working class that isn't going to be able to make $100 or $1,000 contributions,
right,
they can still qualify for an election. But that seems like, it seems like the devil is going to be in the details on this one, where, first of all, what qualifies, and then where the money comes from.
I've talked with the finance department about that and done some estimates. If the number of serious candidates in our races remains the same, the estimate is that roughly the same, that a full system would cost between $150,000 and $200,000 a year annualized, and a partial system about $120,000. That's an annual figure. It's important to understand, because people will immediately say, well, the two mayor candidates spent more than $120,000 last time. If you take the cost of each, a judge council election, a mayor council election, add them together and divide by four over the whole election cycle,
right,
you get the annual estimated cost. And it's averaging in those 2 0 years when there are no campaigns. That's how you get down to those figures. And I'm told that that is too small an amount to even think about a property tax. It would be depend $300,000 to $400,000 house. You're talking somewhere between $4 and $11 a year. And the council would not bother with an ordinance to raise that. They would be able to find it in the existing budget, I'm told, without any increase in taxes.
And they would just have to take it from the existing budget and put it in some bank account marked public financing of campaigns.
Right, that's right. Probably administered by the city clerk.
Now, on a national level, there was, in the last presidential elections, a lot of independent groups and they weren't nonprofits, they weren't 501, but there were some other some other number that was designated.
527.
527, yeah. Thank you. What about groups like that? Where do they factor in? I mean, I don't even know if there are such factors in municipal elections.
That's the most difficult problem for public financing, is those groups and high-spending candidates that don't participate. It's a voluntary system, and people can opt out.
It's a voluntary system?
Oh, yes, it has to be. You can't compel candidates to accept a spending limit, so it's voluntary.
And so the wealthy person can still go in and spend $200,000 on their campaign out of their own pocket.
Yeah, okay. And so a very important part of any well-designed system is the right of candidates, participating candidates, candidates who accept the public money, to additional payments to match their rivals and the independent groups who may support their rivals or oppose them in the event of high spending. And if that offer is generous enough, the likelihood is you'd never have to spend it, because these groups will be deterred from that kind of activity, knowing that it will be futile, because whatever they do or whatever the rival non-participating candidates will do will be matched by the city.
What are some examples of these independent groups? The kind of thing we're talking about.
In Santa Fe, they've been pretty small scale. There was one this year that's called the Judicial Choice Committee that just sprang up to oppose Charter Amendment 7. In 2004, there was a group called Santa Fe Grassroots that had positions on various candidates. Nationally, of course, there's MoveOn.org and the Swift Boat Veterans and so forth.
We're talking to Jim Harrington, who is chair of the City of Santa Fe Charter Review Commission. Well, anything else that we should know or think about in terms of campaign finance reform? If we as a city vote for this, do we then have any influence on how the ordinance is eventually written?
Oh, certainly. In fact, there probably will be a lot of discussion in the council. And the amendment actually provides that the council can appoint other study groups or task forces to decide, to make recommendations, study systems in other cities. By the way, I should mention, it's in place in many other jurisdictions, including three in New Mexico. The city
right?
of Albuquerque, the state PRC elections, and statewide judicial elections all have systems of full public financing with additional matching payments to candidates up to triple in the event of independent groups or others trying to outspend them.
There is a kind of, I don't know if it's mythology or reality in Santa Fe, that we vote for the underdog and it doesn't even matter how much money they spend. You know, Santa Feans can see through the smoke and mirrors that are caused by advertising.
Yeah, that is a mythology. I've gone through the campaign spending records that we still have, all of them, for all of the races that we still have, and it turns out that the big spender has won the majority of races.
Is that right?
There's some spectacular counterexamples that everyone's aware of, but like Ron Trujillo against Carol Robertson Lopez. He was outspent 4-1 and won. There are two or three others that have occurred, and some of these people on the council now, these Davids that slew Goliaths, but they're the exception, not the rule.
Very interesting. So let's move on to the Charter Amendment 5, which is ranked choice voting, also known as instant runoff voting, and I'll just read it. It's an amendment that would require that candidates for municipal office be elected by a majority of voters through ranked choice voting system that combines the initial vote with an instant runoff in a single election. And that is achieved by allowing voters to rank in order of preference each candidate for mayor, city council, and municipal judge. Where does it go from there? So instead of saying, am I going to vote for, last time we had, I think, four mayoral candidates on the ballot, or was it more?
Right, Well, one dropped out.
One dropped out. But instead of saying I vote for this one, I say first choice, second choice, third choice.
Exactly.
What happens then?
That's all the voters have to do, and there are no possibilities of gaming the system to get advantage for your favorite candidate. So for voters, it's very simple. Just look at all the candidates and rank them in the order in which you would prefer them, in the order of your preference. For the clerk, in counting the votes, it's a little more complicated. You would count all the first choices. If someone got a majority of first choice votes, it's over. That they're elected, as that would have happened in our mayor election last time when David Cost did get a majority. But let's assume he didn't. At that point, after counting the first choice votes, no one gets a majority. You eliminate the candidate who got the least votes, which in that case would have been Donato Coviello. And then you pull that candidate's ballots out again, and you look at their second choice and count those, and you add those to the totals of the candidates that are still remaining. And if still no one gets a majority, you take eliminate the least vote candidate and add their second choice votes to those who got that. In that event, you would add Coviello's third choice votes. And finally, you're down to two candidates, and someone automatically gets a majority.
And is this used? Well, first of all, why would you do this instead of doing it the way we do it now?
The reasoning on the commission that led to recommending this was that it's desirable to have our candidates elected by a majority of the voters. At the present time, if there are five candidates running, whoever gets the most votes wins, so that theoretically a person could be elected with 21% of the vote. And we have had councilors and mayors elected with a minority of the voters. And the thinking was that it's not desirable to have our officials in office against whom a majority of the voters have voted against them. So we felt that it was very desirable to have majority support for our officials. And once you decide that, there are really only two ways to get there. One is a traditional runoff election, which they've now reinstated in Albuquerque.
So nobody gets the majority, then there's a new election day, everybody goes back to the polls, they vote again.
Except typically everybody doesn't go. Those have very small turnouts.
Really?
Go ahead, yeah.
Well, and so in that case, let's say there's four candidates and they have another runoff and a new date. Do they just eliminate the bottom candidate and still have three candidates on the ballot?
No, all runoff systems, and that's one of the problems with runoffs. You eliminate everybody but the top two.
Ah.
And if the third place fellow is close and was fairly popular as a second choice with the electorate, he could have won if he'd been in the race finally. But under a traditional runoff, you cut it down to two immediately, and then they face off.
So let's say there's three candidates, and one person gets 40%, and one gets 31%, and the other 29%. That's 100% of the vote. Is it possible that the person with the 30% will actually win because so many people put him as their second choice?
Right, the 29%, I think you said. Yeah, they could win. And that happened in San Francisco has used this for a while, and that actually happened in one of their elections. A board of supervisors candidate who was third on the first round and ended up winning.
Is that right?
Yeah. Right.
And so you wouldn't have a second election day where people have to show up because everybody's put their choices down. So it's just basically a question of somebody writing an algorithm that counts the ranked choices.
And it avoids the cost and delay of a runoff election. That's the main advantage. Another advantage that's cropped up is that it tends to discourage negative campaigning. And that's been the experience in the cities that have used it, because every candidate has to think, if I don't antagonize my opponent's supporters too much, maybe they'll put me second. So they have to be a little nicer to each other than in an election under the current system.
So where do we have ranked choice voting, and how long has it been used in other places in the country?
San Francisco's had the most experience. They've had a few elections. I'm not sure exactly how many. In Australia, they've used it in a lot of elections at all levels of government for many, many years. And let's see, Burlington, Vermont, Minneapolis, St. Paul just adopted it, Tacoma, Washington. And several cities in North Carolina, pursuant to a state law, encouraging cities to use ranked choice.
So that is ranked choice voting. That would go into effect in March of 2010, is that correct?
Yes, but there's a little fudge clause in there that I don't know. I don't recall if you read that or not, about the availability of software to count the votes.
Right.
Yeah, there was a concern to avoid hand counting or hand sorting, and so the council, this was one of the changes they made in the commission's recommendations, put in what Councillor Calvert called a fudge clause that said this will go into effect in 2010 or when software is available to do the entire counting and sorting, whichever is later.
Which, I have to say, wouldn't be very hard. I mean, heck, I could do it if I renewed my computer programming skills.
Right.
It's not a real tough...
And we think the kind of voting machines we use, ES and SM100s, are in use in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and in all the cities in North Carolina. So with all the pressure to have this software developed, we think my guess is it will be available by 2010. It has to be available at a reasonable price. That's in the amendment also.
So this feeds into the whole question of private corporations doing... they're, you know, selling their electronic voting machines and so on. We are going to have to rely on a company. It's not something that the municipality would be responsible for. We have to rely on ENSNS or Diebold or whatever to write these programs.
Yes, yes. In North Carolina, they have used our same machines already in elections, and they've been able to, without additional software, to have them do all the counting, but they've had to do by hand the sorting of the ballots of those who were eliminated. So, for example, in the example I put where they counted the first round for mayor last time and Donato Coviello was eliminated, in the system used in North Carolina, the clerk's office by hand would have to go find all of the Coviello first choice ballots and then run them through the machine to have their second choice counted.
We're talking,
and they've done that in some cities twice our size, and it's, you know, it took a couple of days, but it wasn't a disaster.
And you have a nonpartisan group of people sitting there. Well, but it does lead to sort of potential nightmares of the kind that we had just during the recent caucus, where it took us how many weeks to count the votes in New Mexico?
Yeah, well, that was because they didn't anticipate at all the number of voters. I'm not familiar with all the reasons why it went astray.
We're talking to Jim Harrington, who is chair of the City of Santa Fe Charter Review Commission. The time is 8:31 here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So here is another charter amendment, which I guess has been a little bit controversial lately, and is proposing to amend the Santa Fe City Charter that would require that a candidate for municipal judge be a member of the New Mexico State Bar. So that means you have to be a lawyer who's gone through law school or whatever and passed the bar in order to be elected as municipal judge. What is the impetus behind that amendment?
Well, that one was discussed at greater length in the commission than any other.
And really?
We talked to the head of the Judicial Standards Commission, came and addressed us, studied a lot of statistics. Initially, the commission was very divided on that. There are reasonable arguments to be made both ways. Legal training is important, certainly, but the idea of having a person who's close to the people and understands their problems and so on is also attractive. But what finally swayed us were the statistics that were presented to us by the Judicial Standards Commission. There's been some misuse of these statistics in the press. I saw some recent comments to the effect that a majority of complaints of all the complaints brought to the Judicial Standards Commission against judges, a majority are brought against lawyer judges. That's not a meaningful statistic for a couple of reasons. First place, the majority of judges are lawyers, so you might expect a majority of the complaints to be against them. But more important, complaints are not particularly meaningful because anyone can file one. And although they have to be verified.
And they often
do. Yeah. And the vast majority come from unsuccessful litigants, convicted criminal defendants, people who've lost their civil suit. And they're often accompanied by complaints to the state bar against the other lawyer, their own lawyer, and throwing up they're very unhappy at having lost their lawsuit and looking for anybody to blame. But the more meaningful statistic is the complaints that after full investigation by the commission and full public formal hearings were found meritorious, where a judge was found to have committed a serious abuse and recommended to the Supreme Court for discipline. And of those cases, even though non-lawyer judges are a minority of the judges in our state, they have consistently accounted for 70 to 80% of those cases in which a judge was found to have committed some kind of serious misconduct and recommended for discipline.
So
that was what swayed us. You have a much better chance of avoiding serious abuse if the judge is an attorney. And that's not to say that there aren't good non-lawyer judges and bad lawyer judges, but the odds are better if the person has legal training that's in the courtroom.
So 70 to 80% of the cases where there was a complaint against a judge and that complaint was found to be a valid complaint with merit was
right.
Non-lawyer judges in New Mexico,
right.
Even though they're a small minority. So the statistics are very high.
Yeah, they're not a small minority. They're something like 40-something percent.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's a minority, but not a small minority.
Right.
But still, their proportion of the meritorious complaints is about double their numbers in terms of percentages, and that's what convinced us to recommend what we did.
When what kind of cases are municipal judges hearing?
Misdemeanor, traffic, and other small misdemeanors. They can send people to jail for, I believe, it's up to a year, which is a serious matter.
But you also talk about civil cases.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kinds of. I think they do unlawful detainer actions to evict tenants, that sort of thing. I'm not certain of the.
And so
all the scope of the jurisdiction.
So what would that mean? It would mean that people who are judges right now would stay judges until the end of their terms. Let's say this charter amendment were passed.
Well, the present incumbent municipal judge is a lawyer, so it would not affect her at all. She could run again.
Uh-huh.
If this had passed at the same time that a non-lawyer had been elected, that person would have. It's a complicated issue, but the conclusion of the city attorney, with which I agree, is that person would have been able to serve out a 4-year term, but not run again. But that isn't something we're going to face because the current judge is a lawyer.
Is there only one municipal judge?
Right. But the council could appoint more if they wished. It was considered in the commission, amending the charter, to require two, because it is a very busy court. But it was felt that, you know, that should be up to the council. If there's a serious need, they can do that.
Again, let's compare Santa Fe to other municipalities. In the state of New Mexico, in other states, does the municipal judge have to be a lawyer?
Oh, it varies very widely. I know in the state of New York, there are a lot of non-lawyer judges, which has been a source of a lot of controversy for many years.
There's a huge expose in the New York Times about that.
Right. They ran a series of 6 articles, which recounted many serious problems with their system. In New Mexico, the only city that I know of that requires their municipal judge to be a lawyer is Las Cruces, and that's been in effect for decades.
And do we know how it's going for them in terms of the problems we're looking at here?
I don't know. Yeah, I just know the overall statistics in the state for lawyer and non-lawyer judges.
So that is Charter Amendment Number 7. Should the municipal judge be a lawyer.
Yeah, by the way, this would not affect magistrate judges. The city doesn't have any power to change those. Those are not city officials. They're not elected at the city level.
So let's move on to Charter Amendments 1, 2, and 3. We're kind of lumping them together because they are related to one another. Some of them are for things that seem sort of bureaucratic. Signature collection, the period for collecting petition signatures from 60 to 90 days, to change the method used to determine the number of petition signatures from 20% of registered voters to 33 to one-third of actual voters. You know, what is, and then the next, and there's another signature one. Let's talk about these two petition amendments.
Right. These are called initiative and referendum. And for most, for those who don't know, initiative is a way in which, by circulating a petition, the voters can get on the ballot a law, and then if a majority of the voters vote in favor of it, the law is passed. It's a way. It's a form of direct democracy. You can pass your own laws.
So I could circulate a petition in the city of Santa Fe saying dogs no longer need to be on leashes. I get 70,000 signatures. And then it's law?
No, after the signatures are to get the measure on the ballot, then there's an election held.
Okay.
And if a majority votes to let the dogs off the leashes, that's the law.
And this election, is it on election day, or are there special elections held specifically for these kinds of initiatives?
I think they could do it either way. Typically, to save money, it would be on election day. They could. The city can always call a special election for something.
What kind of cases? I mean, why did this idea even come up?
At first, I should mention the other part of that is what's called a referendum, and that's the same process to repeal a law that is passed by a council. Voters can vote to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. In this case, that's probably the way you do
law,
the
right.
leash thing, is just repeal the leash law, right?
So why the referendum and initiative, why did you... Did the Santa Fe Charter Review Commission choose to bring these questions up?
We just felt that the present system was illogical. There was a 10 years ago, the charter, when the charter was adopted, there was a heated debate about whether to have these measures in the charter or not, and that it was finally done by means of a compromise, wherein they were allowed in the charter. But the level of signatures to get them on the ballot was made so high that it was virtually impossible. And the commission thought that we should lower that so that at least this is not a, so that we don't have in our charter essentially a charade, that that they are realistically available but still very difficult. These would be the few and far between, we would hope.
And so it's not, so this was really not about the any concept that the voters are keen to initiate some particular
No, and in fact, these things have been used for good and bad, as some people have noted. You know, most of the gay bashing and immigrant bashing measures that have been passed at state and local levels around the country have been passed by means of these popular initiatives. We think Santa Fe is a little too progressive for that kind of stuff, but and they once in a while have been co-opted by big money interests. You know, they pay people to get the signatures and then launch a big advertising campaign. I don't know if that would work in a smaller town like Santa Fe. And they've been used to do good things. Most of the public campaign financing measures at the state and local level that have been passed have been done by popular initiative.
And are
including
there
Albuquerque, actually. Yeah.
Are there any safeguards against, for example, the influence of big business, you know, surreptitiously being behind an action of this kind?
Just publicity and word of mouth, which is easier in a small town than it is, for example, in the state of California where this has happened. I'm not sure if any of those have succeeded in California, but there have been ballot propositions there that were essentially to give the give benefits to one industry. And the signature gatherers were paid, and the advertising was paid by that industry. I think, I'm not sure any of them has succeeded.
And what, when you say this can be done for good and for bad, I mean, you know, gay bashing groups wanting to pass some kind of anti-gay...
defense of marriage.
Defense of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How have you seen this in other parts of the country being used for good?
Public financing is the main example. I think there have also been initiatives for a bottle refund promoted by environmentalists that have passed. Those are a couple of examples.
And so this is these things are already in the city charter, but it just amends the number of petition signatures needed and some of the rules around it to make it easier for the citizens to participate in getting something on the ballot to either repeal or initiate new laws.
Yeah, that's right. Presently, the charter requires that you get signatures to get on the ballot of 20% of the registered voters. But since only about a third of the voters vote, even in a mayor election, that means 60% of the people who actually vote. And the illogic of that is that means that you have to get more people to sign your petition to get on the ballot than you have to get to vote for it to pass it. And the effect of this change, well, for one thing, it removes the measure of registered voters, because the rolls of registered voters are inflated by people who have passed away, moved out of town. They aren't purged very often.
Right.
So we made the standard the number of people who actually voted in the last mayor election. There's been some misunderstanding about that, too. I just heard it on the station on the news that was on just before this show, that you have to have actually voted in the last mayor election in order to be able to, or you would have to actually have voted in the last mayor election in order to be able to sign a petition under this amendment. That's not the case. The people who voted in the last mayor election is just a measure of the number of signatures you need. You don't have to vote for mayor once to get to sign the petition. Any registered voter could sign the petition.
That's just how they get the numbers.
That's right, yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, it would be awfully hard to verify who voted in any election.
Right, right. Yeah, especially for the petition gatherers. I mean, the clerk would be able to research it, I presume. But
right, but it would take an awful lot of time.
Right, right.
We're talking to Jim Harrington, who is chair of the City of Santa Fe Charter Review Commission. So anything else that people need to know about Charter Amendments 1 and 2, the referendum and the initiative?
Well, I guess we didn't give the numbers, actually. It would be reduced from 20% of the registered voters to 33% of the actual voters, and the effect of that would be to reduce the number of signatures by about half. And that would mean, for example, for a citywide measure to pass a law at the citywide level, you would need 5,000 signatures, whereas under the present system, you'd need 10,000. And since only 15,000 people vote, you only need, you know, somewhere short of 8,000 to win an election. So we felt the 10,000 was unreasonable. In the 10 years since this has been adopted, no one has even tried to get the number of signatures. Some people have gone into the clerk's office. I heard the Sierra Club had something they wanted to promote, and they found out the requirement and rolled their eyes and walked away.
So gathering 5,000 signatures from Santa Fe registered voters seems a doable thing.
I don't know. I've never actually done myself an effort like that. I know it would be quite difficult.
Be a lot of work.
Yeah.
Okay.
And let's see, number three, were you going to touch on that?
Yes, let's talk about Charter Amendment number three, and that is recall. Tell us about recalling whom?
Recalling an elected public official.
So any elected municipal official.
Right. If a person turned out to be less than what the voters expected after they were elected, they could be recalled and removed from office. That was done to the governor of California a few years ago.
That's right.
Except that this could not be done within a year of the election. And that provision is in the charter and would remain in the charter. And that's to prevent situations which, you know, the losers in an election immediately launch a recall and the city spends all its time conducting elections. But you have to wait at least a year to do this. And it has the same signature requirements, except that if it's a councilor, it would be 33% of the voters who actually voted in the last mayor election in that district.
So that would be one where you actually have to prove that you voted for the...
No. Again, just a number measure. You would need a number of signatures equal to or greater than the number of voters who voted in the last mayor election in your district.
Okay. We have never had a recall that I've heard of in Santa Fe. Is there currently a recall provision at all?
Well, it's the same thing. It takes 20% of the registered voters and is therefore essentially impossible.
Okay, right.
Right.
And so this would be the kind of thing if a councilor campaigns under a platform of repealing leash laws, and then they decide to strengthen the leash laws, you can get all mad and recall them.
Right, right.
Do we know where my heart is? Okay, and so then the last one is powers and duties of the mayor. This would permit the mayor to vote when his or her vote will provide the required number of votes by law for taking action on an issue before the governing body. What does that mean?
Right. That is actually a very technical and narrow amendment, and it's relatively uncontroversial. But again, there's been some misunderstanding of what that would do. In fact, I misspoke a moment ago. What I heard on the radio here was a misunderstanding of this amendment.
That's what I
read in the newspaper this morning, a misunderstanding of the number of signatures for Charter Amendments 1, 2, 3. But this...
What we heard on KSFR News a moment ago was that this would give the mayor the right to vote not just as a tiebreaker, but in all in all votes of the that go before the city council.
Right.
That's not true?
That's not true. That was considered by the commission, and it was a divided vote on that issue. I was one of the ones who would have preferred to give the mayor the vote on all issues. But the only thing for which we could get a majority was a very narrow expansion of the mayor's right to vote that is absolutely necessary. It remedies a really unjust situation. And what it says is that there are certain situations, normally on the council, a majority of those present and voting will carry a measure, but there are some state laws that require, in certain special situations, that a majority of the governing body vote for it, regardless of who's present. So, for example, if there were a controversial issue which had divided the council 4-4, and it was known that the mayor, if he broke the tie, would break it in favor of position A, one of the councilors favoring position B could prevent action by simply staying away. The vote would be 4-3 for position A. The mayor could not add his vote because there was no tie. And the vote would not satisfy state law because there would be a majority of the governing body. You'd need 5 votes. So this would say that in that situation, the mayor can vote, make it 5-3. The action can be effective under state law. And that's really all it does.
So hang on. If we have a vote that goes before the city council right now, there's 8 city councilors. And one of them is home with the flu, and so there's 7 city councilors, and they pass something 4-3. It doesn't pass?
Well, no. Most measures would pass. There are just a few state laws, and I can't tell you right offhand what they are, that require that for certain types of actions, it wouldn't pass in that situation. You'd need 5 votes. It's a rather rare situation.
So there is state law that says that when cities address issues concerning something, concerning water or dog leashes or whatever, that you have to have a majority of the governing body there.
That's exactly right.
But that's not true for most issues that come before the council?
That's right. That's right. It's a very narrow number of issues. So, and that's why this amendment has been blown out of proportion a bit in the press. It really is a very small and technical issue that's at stake here.
And basically the rationale behind it is to prevent manipulation of issues by having this tactic of just staying away, that of one counselor who doesn't want something to be passed, just staying away for one day.
That's right. In addition to the inconvenience, if one counselor did have the flu, the council would have to take this issue up again, debate it again, vote on it again when all the councilors were healthy. And that's an inconvenience and a delay. It would solve that situation, too.
So there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. We have gone through the 7 charter amendments. This is the product, these charter amendments that we are voting on today are the result of quite a lengthy process by you and the Charter Review Commission.
That's right.
What kind of folks were on that? How many people were on it? And what was the nature of that review process?
There were 8 of us. There would have been 9, but one counselor chose not to appoint anybody to the commission for reasons I'm not sure. The appointments were to be made by each member of the governing body, so the mayor only had 1 appointment and each counselor had an appointment. And we were the ordinance setting up the commission was passed in early 2005, but the council delayed a long time in making the appointments. We weren't appointed until November 30, 2005, and began deliberating at that point. And we held 13 meetings, some of them for over 3 hours, in the course of the next year, and finally rendered our report and recommendation to the council in January 07, excuse me. 06 was essentially the year in which we operated. During that time, we debated about 30 proposals.
What were some of the ones that didn't make it on?
Let me just look here. One was for one we did approve initially, and then we were advised by the city attorney that we couldn't do it constitutionally in New Mexico, which was term limits. That, according to a court of appeals holding about 10 years ago, violates what's called the qualifications clause in our Constitution that says you can't impose additional qualifications on municipal candidates. So that one we had. The others were, we considered holding elections in the fall. Let me just look at our report here and I'll run through some of those. Electing some councilors at large. That one would have required such a major adjustment in city government that we just felt it was too much in the absence of a demonstrated need for it. It would have added or subtracted, added a council seat, for example, and that would have, or subtracted a council seat. Another we considered was converting to what's called a strong mayor form of government. We have what's known as a weak mayor form of government. The mayor is a member of the city council, chairs the city council, has a vote, but has no veto, limited powers of appointment. Albuquerque has a strong mayor form of government, which is similar to the state and federal governments, where the executive, the mayor, doesn't even go to the council meetings, doesn't participate, but has a veto power, which can only, and makes proposals to the council and they can act on them, and has a veto power which the council can override only by a two-thirds vote. That's
a very big difference.
Yeah, and that a lot of people in town did favor that system, would rather have a stronger mayor. But again, the problem was a major overhaul. There's no jurisdiction in the world in which an executive with a veto power is also a member of the legislature. And so we would have had to remove the mayor from the governing body and pull him out of the council meetings, which would have meant, again, adding or subtracting a council member. And the difficulty of getting that through the council on the ballot would have been tremendous. So we chose to stick with our current system.
And is there, I mean, I would think it would be hard to evaluate which system is more appropriate and fitting for any municipality.
It is, and it probably depends on, you know, immediate issues. If the mayor favors something you like and you wish he had been able to veto it, then you're for a strong mayor government.
Right.
Otherwise not. I'm just thumbing through our report here to get, there's a lot, we discussed in our report all the things that we didn't do. One on ranked choice, one a proposal we considered there and rejected again by a divided vote was the possibility of offering the voters a choice between ranked choice voting and traditional runoffs. There would have been two amendments on the ballot. You could only vote for one, not the other. Because of ballot confusion and because ranked choice seemed to be so clearly superior to traditional runoffs in terms of cost and speed with which you get the election results, we ended up deciding just to put on the ballot ranked choice and not traditional runoffs. Another thing in our charter, and this is peculiar to Santa Fe, is it makes our mayor even weaker than most weak mayor forms of government, is the governing body's power, the council's power, to fire the city manager without the concurrence of the mayor. And we considered taking that out and rejected that by a divided vote. We would have required the mayor and the council to concur in firing the city manager. Another we considered very briefly was allowing the governing body by two-thirds to amend the charter. That's what they have in Albuquerque.
Uh-huh.
And we felt the charter should remain like the U.S. Constitution, very hard to amend a basic law. Albuquerque's is about an inch thick, and everything in the kitchen sink is in there because of the ease with which it can be amended.
Whereas you guys had to have a charter review commission that was really an independent body with people from pretty much every district who worked for a year, but it wasn't people who necessarily had political interest.
No, I guess there was only one current office holder. For the vice chair, Frank Montaño, was a member of the school board and a former counselor.
Right.
But we had, I guess, three lawyers on there. One, a retired law professor, Ruth Cognat, Frank Herdman, and I, and other interested citizens. I could name them all if you like, but
We're actually out of time.
Uh-huh.
But Jim Harrington, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Jim Harrington is chair of the City of Santa Fe Charter Review Commission. Review of the city charter happens only every 10 years, and the seven amendments that were proposed were the ones that came out of a lengthy process of review. They're going up in front of the voters today. So, ladies and gentlemen, get yourselves out to the polls and vote. It is your right and it is your duty. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes, which means it'll land in your iTunes every day if you've got iTunes. If not, you can just go to santafe.radiocafe.org and click listen, and it will play in your headphones or in your computer speakers. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow, and by the way, tomorrow is the first Wednesday of the month, which means we're going to be talking about animals during the first half of the show. We're also going to have Natalie Goldberg on the air, so that and much, much more here on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR 101.1. Hasta la vista. Ciao.